Well, I'd like to welcome everyone to today's weather training teleclass entitled Commissioning for Infection Prevention. And I'm absolutely thrilled to bits that we've got Debbie King, whose title is the Deputy Chief Nurse at Solihull Clinical Commissioning Group, to present the teleclass for us today. She's an old friend of weather training and an old personal friend of mine. And Debbie's worked in this field of infection prevention and control for many years. She's led on several initiatives on behalf of the ICNA, as was, now the IPS, including the development of competencies and work on intravenous line management. And she's also been a leader around commissioning of services, really before any of us took it as seriously as we needed to. So she's always one step ahead of the game. With major changes in the NHS in England about to hit us, commissioning of infection prevention services is a really important aspect of our work. So I'm absolutely thrilled that Debbie's free today to be able to present the teleclass, Commissioning for Infection Prevention, and I'd like to hand over to Debbie King.
Thank you very
Welcome,
much,
Debbie,
for those kind words. Less of the old, I think, but yes, we have. I've been around for quite some time. I'd like to start by just thanking Paul and Maria and Vanessa from the organising committee of the teleclass series for inviting me to present. It does feel quite strange for me to be on this side of the telephone, having hosted several of these teleclasses in the last few years. So I hope what I have to say today about some of the work that we've been doing is useful for those of you that have joined us today. If you go to the first slide, the aims of this session are really to provide an overview of how the recent reorganisation of the NHS following the Liberating the NHS paper and white paper impacts on infection prevention and how we can use this to our advantage to bring about real and sustained reductions in HCAI and improvements to infection prevention practice and across the whole health economy, really, not just in the traditional acute provider settings. The next slide. I think it's just worthwhile really to start off with just having a quick refresher around what is commissioning. For those of us that sort of work in it every day, it's second nature, but maybe not so much to infection prevention staff working in traditional providers. I think really it's about ensuring that the commission is securing the services to meet the needs of the local populations which they serve. It's about making sure that we get the best quality balanced with value for public money and to improve the quality of services for patients through clearly defined outcomes, improved efficiencies, and as we've heard more recently around the C. diff agenda in recent years, around reducing variation, taking out the postcode lottery and ensuring that wherever you are in the country, that you know you get services that are commissioned to the same standard and same quality regardless of where you live. So the next slide really diagrammatically presents what constitutes the commissioning cycle. And you can see from this, it obviously puts the patients and public clearly at the heart of everything we do. There is an element of strategic planning around needs analysis and assessment for your population, which then translates into procuring services to meet those needs and ensuring that the pathways of care that patients move through meet those needs and then go on to monitor and evaluate those pathways, not just in terms of performance, but also around the quality that you get for the patient. It's around supporting patient choice, so that they can actually receive the appropriate care, preferably in the point nearest to their home. But again, wherever the care is delivered, that it is actually delivered to a good quality, and we take into consideration the patient's needs and views, and engaging with the patient at the whole point of the circle when we are deciding on priorities, designing services, and then obviously securing how those services are provided. So the next slide just shows, in terms of our function and role as commissioners, where our relationships lie across the entire of the health and social care economy. And clearly there you can see that we have our biggest group are obviously the providers, those that actually we secure the provision of services through, whether those are mental health services, acute services, primary care services, continuing health care, etc., etc. And also includes ambulance trusts and providers as well. And also we have an interrelationship with other commissioners according to geographical area, because whilst there are notional boundaries, clearly patients move between providers, they move between areas, and it's really ensuring that we are all, if you like, playing from a level playing field in terms of services that are provided whilst meeting the needs of the populations assessed through joint strategic needs assessments. And then you can see that there is also the interrelationship around the local authority, particularly around care homes and domiciliary providers, and included in that, obviously, are continuing healthcare providers. And you can see the CQC, clearly as the quality regulator, we have a clear interrelationship because as commissioners, the work that we do around quality assurance, in the same way, the CQC are also doing that in a regulatory framework, and it's essential that we interrelate and share and triangulate information that we have through our distinct lines of work and responsibilities. So the next slide then, how does all of this work? Well, up until the 31st of March, 1st of April this year, primary care trusts commission services on behalf of their population. And I think it's worth just mentioning at this point in time that until the 31st of March, PCTs remained the legal entity until the CCGs take over on the 1st of April. And for PCTs and subsequently going forward CCGs, we have to set the priorities around services that we deliver for our population. And again, referring back to the diagram on a previous slide, from those set priorities, we state to the providers what intentions we have to commission which services from them. Those are then developed into service specifications, which then go into contracts, and there is, as I'm sure you're all aware, a national contract that we use. And part of that contract, as well as the service specifications, are obviously all of the metrics against which we measure the provider around performance and quality in delivering the services that they provide. And the performance, the sort of monitoring of the performance is clearly through the two routes, the financial route, but more importantly for me, the quality route. And if we move on to the next slide, I think it's important to highlight that all of the work that went on around commissioning historically to improve the process of commissioning, which at the time was badged the world-class commissioning programme, the Department of Health at the time felt that all of the processes around securing services for patients were actually, decisions were far too removed from patients and divorced from clinical influence. And this is what resulted, going to the next slide, in the NHS White Paper, Equity and Excellence Liberating the NHS. And this document was clearly around putting quality and putting patients at the forefront of all commissioning of NHS service provision. Improving quality healthcare outcomes with a particular focus on safety and quality. But also it was around reducing the bureaucracy, improving efficiencies and providing commissioners with autonomy and accountability. And as we move on to the next slide, we'll discuss each one of those issues individually and how that actually impacts on the service and the environment that we now find ourselves in. So So the next slide, cutting bureaucracy. There was a clear drive that the NHS needed to save £20 billion in efficiencies by 2014, and that those efficiencies should be reinvested to support quality and improve outcomes for patients. The ambition to reduce NHS management costs by 45% and free up these finances for frontline care, I don't think anyone could challenge that actually those intentions were sound. But they also wanted to simplify NHS bodies, reduce the level of autocracy from the Department of Health, and abolish quangos. In essence, making the whole system much leaner, and to be able to bring a refocus onto quality. And moving on to the next slide, this in turn would allow greater freedom from political micromanagement and devolve the commissioning power closer to the patient. And in the very, very early days, it was called GP commissioning, but now it is clear that it is much wider and that nursing has a real value in part of the new commissioning, clinical commissioning groups, which we will discuss in more detail shortly. They needed to really re-emphasise the joined-upness between local authority and NHS in regards to social care and health improvement, recognising that patients aren't just health patients or social care patients, but they move across the entire economy between these providers, bringing their health needs and their issues with them. And we really needed to tie up and provide consistency across the whole pathway, ensuring quality and a whole new approach to integrated care. And part of this was around, in terms of reducing the bureaucracy, establishing the NHS Commissioning Board. Clearly, we'll move on to describe how the new structures look, but part of the whole system still includes the economic regulator for trust, so we still have Monitor, and also the CQC with regards to the quality regulator. Moving on to the next slide around improving healthcare outcomes, the shift really is around reducing mortality and morbidity and increasing safety and encouraging a culture of open information, active responsibility and challenge. This is one of the key things for commissioners, is that we seek assurance from providers around their safety culture, around their performance, and challenge the data that they provide and really get to the heart of what's going on in service provision for patients. And with all of that combined, then obviously we are looking at improving the experiences for patients and also improving outcomes. And the national contract allows commissioners to be able to pay accordingly around their performance and their quality, and not just basically on their activity. So it gives us a real platform to start to improve the quality and safety culture in providers, and to reflect outcomes, and also to provide an incentive for quality improvement. And we will come back to those incentives and how they look shortly. Moving on to the next slide, the sort of final ambition, if you like, of liberating the NHS is putting patients first. The ambition of no decision about me without me, allowing patients to be engaged in the provision of services where they actually receive their care, and having a choice of providers, whether that be acute hospital or closer to home in community or primary care settings. But it really is to put patients at the heart of the decision making about their care and where they receive their care. And the ongoing ambition for patients to be able to rate the hospitals and the care according to the quality they receive. And many of you will be familiar with the friends and family test, where patients are asked by providers going forward whether they would recommend that provider to their friends and family. So really about patients and what they feel about services. Moving on to the next slide, this rather confusing jumble of boxes, which is on some days what it feels like to be working in this during this time of transition, is a diagrammatic representation really of what the new system looks like. So if we just talk through this very briefly, clearly the Department of Health is still at the helm, with the NHS Commissioning Board sitting directly underneath them. That NHS Commissioning Board is split into a number of area teams, and those area teams oversee the clinical commissioning groups, or CCGs, and it's referred to in this diagram as GP Commissioning Consortia. This was one of the early diagrammatic representations. But for GP Commissioning Consortia, we now are talking about CCGs. Both CCGs clearly interplay with the providers and also local authorities as part of the sort of health and wellbeing board, and the establishment of those boards being driven through local authorities from public health, which, as you can see, also has an interplay to Public Health England, which is currently being set up across the country, which again feeds back into the Department of Health. On the right-hand side of the diagram, you can see how the local authority and the adult social care side fits in with regards to, again, the Health and Wellbeing Board. And the NHS Commissioning Board, you will see a dotted arrow to providers, because the NHS Commissioning Board will have a remit for commissioning a number of services across the board, both in terms of primary care for GPs, for dentists and optometrists, but also some of the more specialist services across the board. And then you can also see on the side the sort of interrelations again between Monitor as the economic regulator currently and the CQC for quality, and also the patient group, the new health watch that's being set up, and again beneath those the local health watch groups that will be liaising and in relationships with both commissioning groups and the providers to ensure that there's triangulation of information across the board in the new system. So if we look specifically then onto the next slide with regards to the role of CCGs, CCGs in many respects, like PCTs, have a number of statutory duties, one of which I've listed here is complaints, and I don't propose to list all of the others. I think the important thing for us to note is that actually we also have a remit for quality assurance around our commissioned providers. And to also have a role in terms of quality improvement, both in terms of our service providers, but also you'll see there the term member practices. And just to explain that, CCGs are made up of a governing body with GPs on the board, but every GP practicing GP has to be a member of a CCG, and it's those that we refer to as the member practices. And one of the duties of a CCG is to ensure quality improvement of those member practices in terms of primary medical care. You may ask yourself, well, how do we differ from the old PCT? And I think it's important to highlight that actually there are quite significant differences. And the primary one is that as a CCG, we are not responsible for commissioning and holding the contracts for primary medical practices. That firmly sits with the National Commissioning Board. But we do have an obligation to support our practices to improve the quality in primary care that they provide to their patients and their population. Moving on to the next slide, we start talking really now about how the whole process links together. And you'll all be familiar, I'm sure, with the National Outcomes Framework. And here we just have the, as an aid memoir really, listed the five domains around which the National Outcomes Framework for Patients are pinned. And all of the work that we do in regards to commissioning, securing service provision, and monitoring are all around these outcomes, ensuring that we're preventing people from dying prematurely, enhancing quality of life for people with long-term conditions, helping people recover from episodes of ill health or injury, ensuring that people have a positive experience of care, and that patients are treated and cared for in a safe environment, protecting them from avoidable harm. And the new contract, all of the indicators in those contracts are all really pinned around those five domains. If you move on to the next slide, I think increasingly now, and you will all, I'm sure by now, have at least read the executive summary of the Francis report into the events at mid-staff. Quality is key. Lord Darcy referred and defined quality in his original Next Stage review as being safety, effectiveness and patient experience. And it's really around these three pillars of quality that the whole commissioning cycle for quality assurance and quality improvement is actually based. Moving on to the next slide, we start really talking now about what all this means in practice. It all sounds very straightforward in theory, but what does this actually mean? And particularly, what does it mean in terms of infection prevention? We're looking at a population approach across all commission services. So it's really, if we look at C. diff, for example, it's recognising that actually patients may start antimicrobial treatment in primary care as part of their long-term condition management. That may then result in a period of hospitalisation where they have further treatment. And then finally, they'll be discharged back out to the care of their primary care physician, where if they then actually develop diarrhoea, symptoms of C. diff, then obviously it's really about pinning this whole system together and how do we tackle the whole system approach to services to improve quality and safety for patients. It's about recognising the diversity of providers across acute and community and being able to bring all of those together, working with other commissioners to ensure that these pathways of care that patients embark on are safe across the entire pathway around community and the plethora of providers from primary care, community care, acute care and often tertiary care and ongoing continuing health care to ensure that safety and quality for patients is maintained across the whole gambit. Moving on to the next slide, that means we are procuring new services and often redesigning services to maximise quality, setting quality indicators and performance measures across those current services and for the new services, and identifying where those services are effective or where in fact we might need to influence commissioning services or decommission services, as is sometimes the case. It's about recognising what services we may want to commission, particularly with regards to infection, around reducing the risk of infection. So, for example, if a patient has norovirus and they get admitted, is that the best place for them to be? Or can we provide safe, high-quality care by an alternate provider without them being in hospital, but with being with a different provider, but ensuring that that care is safe and delivered to a high standard? Working with independent practitioners, GPs and the NHS Commissioning Board is essential in ensuring that these entire pathway approaches are delivered. Moving on to the next slide, we're then talking about really assuring the quality of those services and how, as commissioners, are we assured that we are preventing any future recurrence of the events for mid-staff. And influencing the systems for future assurance as we move forward with the transition to the new NHS architecture. Moving on to the next slide, I think what it doesn't mean is that we micromanage trust. Trusts still have to have their own internal assurance for both their financial regulators and also the CQC. But as commissioners of services, we do require robust assurance around a gambit of metrics, but particularly for me, around quality, quality assurance and quality improvement for patients. So moving on to the next slide, we start talking about how we actually do this. And we have a great deal of support through the national contract. The contract is there where we actually include a number of metrics that are national metrics to be able to facilitate benchmarking and comparison. But we also have wherewithal through the contract to include a number of local quality metrics related to our own service providers based on intelligence that we have on their services, to be able to develop new services and again to provide assurance of the standard and quality in the current contractual year. We also have within the contract not just indicators but a schedule that relates to information that we require. So a lot of the infection prevention related data, which I'll talk about a little bit more later, is often found in this quality, in this information schedule, whereas the MRSA reductions, or in this case this year, the zero tolerance of MRSA and the C. diff reductions are in the nationally mandated quality indicator section of the KPI. In regards to quality improvement, we have the sequin framework, and I will talk about that a little bit more shortly. But then, obviously, not related to the contract with regards to providers, we also are accountable, as I mentioned earlier, around primary care quality improvement. This isn't assurance, because the primary care quality assurance will clearly be done by the NHS Commissioning Board. But we do need to be working with our members to identify quality profiles, what constitutes good quality care in primary care, and to be able to build a picture and data around that for our practices, and then agree with them development plans around how we can make improvements on those areas and be able to demonstrate to the governing body of the CCG and also the NCB that we are actually working to improve the quality of primary care. Moving on to the next slide, this is an example of the contract and how it's set out. This is actually from last year's contract. The contract for 13-14 is currently still in draft, a draft that they call the almost final version. And it does look slightly different to this, but it's just really an indicator of the different sections in the contract that we are able to use to influence infection prevention. And clearly this year the zero tolerance around MRSA, there are set reductions for C. diff, and clearly within that there are adjustment tables which as commissioners and performance managers we can actually impose where providers are over their proposed outturn for the year. It clearly also says in the contract that providers will share their HCAI reduction plan for the contract year with the commissioners. And we'll come back to that in a little bit more detail around what that looks like when we start talking about some of the work that IPS and RCN have done together around commissioning toolkits for infection prevention. Moving on to the next slide. This is a representation of a sequin. This is not an infection prevention related sequin in its entirety, although it does refer to urinary tract infection reductions. The sequins are really there to provide the commissioners with an opportunity to incentivise quality improvement by the providers. And essentially, financially, they work by commissioner releasing payments over a milestone basis over the year as the provider is able to demonstrate improvement to an agreed trajectory with regards to the overarching improvement scheme. So if you look here, it refers to the NHS safety thermometer. It gives a description of what that does, how much the weight of that will be, and the sequence scheme, generally speaking, refers is 2.5% of the overarching contract value. So actually, for providers, there's a real financial incentive to bring around these quality improvements against quarterly agreed milestones. And sequins are really there to sort of bring about improvement in year one, with the theory that moving into year two, the metrics within that sequin will then develop into a KPI for ongoing monitoring in year, and then in year three go into the information schedule, whereby then it would be anticipated that that improvement is firmly embedded into the provider's thoughts around that particular project. Again, with regards to the sequins, there are a number of national sequins that the providers can sign up to. And as commissioners, we also have the gift to be able to collaborate with providers to identify areas where they can see that local improvements can be made and work up local sequins. And this is an ideal opportunity to consider where a sequin around infection prevention may be developed, for example, to introduce or roll out surgical site surveillance or post-discharge surveillance, whereby the projects are actually managed on a quarterly milestone basis and finances are released as we go along. There's no requirement for the providers to sign for these, but if they don't, then they don't receive the money, the sequin money that's part of the financial framework. So there really is, a good incentive for them to do these quality improvements, because they can actually equate to very large sums of money and actually do bring about significant improvements in terms of quality for patients. If we go on to the next slide, I want to just now talk about how infection prevention has come to be integral, really, into the commissioning world, as it were, because I think in terms of infection prevention, there has been a natural progression that's led to infection prevention practitioners working directly in commissioning services. And you'll all recognise, I'm sure, a number of these key documents that have been issued in the history of our specialty, dating back to the Cook Report, the PHLS infection prevention in the community study, and then really moving on to where we are now with regard to the Health and Social Care Act. Traditionally, infection prevention was a hospital-based topic, but I think it was soon recognised that, we needed infection prevention specialists in the community, and it's really how those community specialists have ended up in commissioning organisations is actually fairly interesting. But if you move on to the next slide, I think the other compounding factors around this really was as the profile of HCAI really soared with rising infection rates. We had a number of nationally reported incidents, particularly Stoke Mandeville and the Mid-South Inquiry. Moving on to the next slide, there was clearly an increased emphasis on commissioning and how quality could be improved, how safety could be improved, and clearly infection prevention is integral to the entire patient safety agenda. We had a position where Infection prevention nurses, because of the PHLS community guidance around having specialist community infection control nurses, PCTs as they were then, and providing at that time community services, started to employ infection prevention nurses to provide services to infection community nurses and other community providers, and similarly primary care providers. So as commissioning and provider organisations at the time, infection control nurses found themselves in commissioning organisations almost by accident, really. And as is our kind of wont, I suppose, you can't keep a good infection control nurse down. If she gets an opportunity to discuss the specialty at any level, whether that be with a provider or a commissioner, they will do so. And it's through that environment, really, that we started to see the role of infection prevention and specialist advice into the whole commissioning agenda. And then Transforming Community Services was published, which really stated that there was a conflict of interest around primary care, commissioning and providing community services. So community services were rehoused. In some areas, they were large enough to become organisations in their own right. In other areas, they became part of other provider organisations, and some of those community services would have gone through integrated care partnerships, such as mental health trusts. And in some cases, they also became part of acute trusts. And we have acute trusts that now have primary community care providers as part of their sort of directory of services, as it were. And in moving those services across, because infection prevention nurses spent a lot of time advising these individuals, some staff were actually two-peed across as part of these transforming community services arrangements. A small number of us were actually retained within PCTs, and actually it's from here really that the role of infection prevention commissioning nurses, for want of a better title, really started to blossom. But if you move on to the next slide and we look and see in more detail how infection prevention and control fits into the commissioning agenda, I think it's fairly clear when you match the role and function of infection prevention against the quality agenda in terms of the outcomes framework, there's no doubt that we are an integral part of Domain 5, promoting safety and ensuring that patients receive their treatment in a safe environment, protecting them from avoidable harm. And it's here clearly around the indicators. We're talking about zero tolerance of MRSA, we're talking about C. diff, but then on a more quality monitoring level, over and above those indicators, we start asking for more detail from providers around their infection prevention practices, compliance with their policies, their hand washing compliance, cleaning standard compliance, compliance with patients for MRSA screening. And we could go on, and I'll go on a little bit more about that in a moment. But it's not just about Domain 5. Actually, if you move on to the next slide, we can see that actually there are also links for us in infection prevention back to patient experience, ensuring that patients have a positive experience of care. I don't think any of us could argue that, you know, a healthcare-associated infection does not represent a positive experience of care to patients. And similarly, around effectiveness, we need to make sure that we are helping people to recover from episodes of illness without providing them with any further risk of ongoing illness. And this is particularly pertinent around the C. diff agenda and ensuring that patients are receiving treatment but don't put them at further risk of additional burdens of infection such as C. diff. So if we move on to the next slide then, what does it feel like to be an infection prevention nurse working in a commissioning environment? What does it mean in a day in our lives? Well, what do we do? Well, we work directly with commissioners, contract managers and providers. Many of you will be aware that this time of year is particularly frantic in the commissioning world as we work with providers on the contracts for the next coming year to ensure that we have the right indicators, that we can measure the right things from providers to ensure that we get good outcomes and quality for patients. This includes negotiating the objectives, in particular around other indicators for HCA over and above the mandatory MRSA and CDEF. But then going forward, we're seeking assurance of how the processes by providers are actually working out in terms of being able to demonstrate improvement and good quality and safe care for patients. And provide challenge back into those providers. And this is where having a specialist infection prevention background is actually very helpful in commissioning, because we are able to challenge what providers are telling us. But it's not really just about infection prevention. You know, you could apply that principle to many specialties, which is why nursing is so well represented across the board in commissioning now in the CCGs with a nurse at board level, to be able to challenge a number of the quality and safety metrics across the board and not just HCAI. The other important thing that we need to do is really to set the health economy agenda for HCAI reductions, being mindful, as we mentioned before, around patient pathway movements from primary into secondary care and back out or into continuing health care, and the interrelationship that all of those providers have in terms of patient safety and outcomes around infection. And we could give a number of numerous examples, not just CDEF, but catheter care management. You know, we have the safety thermometer around reducing urinary tract infections associated with catheter in the acute trust. We need to make sure that that also translates across the board to continuing healthcare contracts in the community and in nursing homes and residential homes as well. So if we look at how we do this on a day-to-day level, again, it is about a health economy approach. We do have the contract to be able to do this, to hold providers to account for the services that they provide. But we're also able to use our specialist knowledge to be able to rationalise. You know, it is very challenging to have the reductions in CDIF that we have for this year. It's very challenging to have zero tolerance. And it's the contract managers need specialist advice and support to be able to interpret what is avoidable. And without, you know, infection prevention specialists in commissioning and supporting primary care and the whole pathway, it is actually very difficult to be able to bring around sensible contracting decisions around payments, to not penalise trusts where really sometimes these breaches may be out of their control. So it's around rationalising and engaging with providers to ensure that we are maintaining a good standard and high quality care. And if we move on to the next slide, part of that includes around coordinating a health economy approach to developing a broad strategy to which all key stakeholders in that health economy are signed up. And this is often challenging, particularly around social care, residential care, but with the new healthcare architecture and the new model of infection prevention, which we'll move on to shortly, hopefully we will actually be able to plug a number of those gaps also. If you move on to the next slide, I just want to talk for a few minutes about the role of the Infection Prevention Society and the Royal College of Nursing in terms of this broad agenda around commissioning. Some time ago, the IPS and RCN recognised that there were a number of their members in both organisations that were working in commissioning organisations with very little support and framework to influence infection prevention. At that time, the two organisations signed up to a collaborative for a short-term, sort of two-year piece of work to provide members with guidance of how to navigate through the potential changes in the system whilst maintaining the level of specialist input into the whole commissioning process. And the group undertook a number of pieces of work, the one being the position statement around how key it is to have infection prevention in the commissioning agenda and to keep it high in the ambition and cognitive framework during the transition to the new services. And that statement is currently being revised. Because clearly a number of changes are in process at the moment. One of the pieces of work we did was to map the functions of infection prevention across the new proposed NHS architecture and provide an options appraisal for people to identify which area of the new world they might find themselves in. And I think it's clear from the public health outcomes framework that there is a real emerging role for infection prevention in public health, which is going into local authority, into public health teams. But I think what we have at the moment is still a plurality of models around how infection prevention is provided. We clearly have some infection prevention practitioners embedded and employed within clinical commissioning groups. Some of those practitioners have actually transitioned into public health and will be providing support to clinical commissioning groups, probably through service level agreements under the banner of public health and the health and wellbeing boards, and that route into the commissioning cycle. And there are obviously also opportunities, although whether or not one would argue that this would go back to a conflict of interest, there are also there's also the model of support being provided from acute providers, but that one probably is fewer in number than the previous two. And the third piece of work that the collaborative undertook was to develop a commissioning toolkit, a basket of indicators really, to be able to ensure that information in regards to infection prevention are put into contracts. And whilst it supports infection prevention nurses, it was also aimed to provide support to generalist nurses on commissioning boards and in commissioning organisations who perhaps don't have specialist knowledge, to be able to ensure that the specialty is represented through the entire level of the contract. That document was published late last year, and it is the intention that document will continue to be the case. We are having a meeting with the Royal College of Nursing. We're running a workshop at the RCN's annual infection prevention study day in March, where we will actually also then be looking at how we can take this work forward to the next step, to be able to ensure that members of both organisations are provided with a robust framework and sound information to be able to uphold the quality and standards of infection prevention through the commissioning route. If we move on to the next couple of slides, I think really we're now talking around what does the future hold for us. We are still transitioning until the 1st of April. A number of infection prevention staff working in commissioning organisations are starting to see dual roles really as part of embedding infection prevention practice and HDR reduction into the broader quality agenda. And I think this is a good thing. We are seeing now greater involvement around a public health director, and you'll all be familiar with the latest guidance around post-infection reviews and zero tolerance of MRSA bacteremia, and the role that the director of public health across the health economy will have in that system of work. So lots of changes, I think, are going to continue over the next months and years whilst the new system settles down. I think there are great opportunities here for infection prevention nurses to be able to influence the agenda across the commissioning spectrum and through the public health. Moving on to the next slide, clearly reducing HCAIs and addressing issues relating to antimicrobial resistance are still a priority for the Department of Health and the government. So, you know, it's not gone away. And clearly the challenges, given where we've come in terms of reduction. You know, 3 years ago, nobody thought we'd really be talking about reducing MRSA to nothing, and yet here we are. And so I think the challenges for us going forward will now be around other organisms and improving infection prevention practice across the board. Moving on to the next slide, it's clearly embedded into the whole new commissioning clinical commissioning group framework and the NCB. It's part of the outcome framework, the commissioning outcomes framework. It's in the public health outcomes framework. So the legislation is all there around it to continue to have it embedded across the board. And again, the next slide just provides a little bit more detail about how that looks in terms of reducing HCAI. So as we come to the end, I just really want to kind of say, well, what is it about the future, what our future might hold in terms of infection prevention and commissioning? Clinical commissioning groups do need specialist input. Now, whether or not this is, whether they employ their staff, they buy it externally, or they share with neighbouring CCGs, that's still actually being played out. And clearly, the role of the nurse in public health and local authorities also play into that entire arena. There's no doubt that the emphasis of healthcare provision and quality is around harm-free care, and in relation to infection prevention, you know, we are right up there in preventing harm to patients around infections, and also around providing patients with a positive experience of care, and again, preventing healthcare-associated infections at whatever point in the health economy or the patient's care pathway is integral to improving their positive experience. And finally, I just wanted to obviously not overlook again the Francis report. And I think particularly at this time with the publication of this report and everyone is working through the implications of that report and how we translate that into practice, not just in terms of infection prevention, but across the whole quality arena. There will be additional advice and guidance come out from the Department of Health that I'm sure will impact on infection prevention. And I hope that, you know, again, infection prevention practitioners take this opportunity to seize the opportunities here for improvement on the back of the Francis report. So with that, I'd just like to say I hope that this very quick and whistle-stop run-through of commissioning and how infection prevention can be part of that important agenda has been useful. And I'd just like to say thank you very much for listening.
Debbie, thank you very much for that really informative presentation. Can I just ask you one question to kind of finish with? A gut reaction question, really. Do you think, on balance, the robustness of all the work that you're doing about commissioning and really influencing infection prevention is going to be better in the new world?
I think so, yes. I think it will probably take some time, because I think what is clear is that providers, certainly from the experience that I have talking with providers from around the country, really, in doing this work, I don't think they really necessarily have appreciated how the whole system works. And hopefully by being able to raise the profile through infection prevention, it's provided another vehicle to be able to support provider infection prevention staff, because again, Maria, just using the sequence, for example, you know, a provider can come and say, well, we really want to do this, can you support us in doing that? And obviously we are in a position to be able to do that. So I think as the system beds itself out and providers begin to know who's who and what's what in the new system, and the right people are put into post, and people start to understand where the services are in the new world, then I think it will certainly make a difference. It's all around, the real thrust now is around quality.
Absolutely, and I don't think any of us listening would go against that in view of what's happened recently with the publication of Francis. So that's really a great positive note to finish on, Debbie. I think you've made a really complex subject very clear to follow, and I hope that the people listening have now got a really strong understanding not only of what's ahead in the infection prevention role, but also in the broader view of what the NHS, new NHS from April the 1st, is truly going to look like. So I'd really like to thank Debbie for that. But before I go, I just need to emphasise to everybody who wants to join a teleclass that actually happens at an inconvenient time of the day for you, because you may be listening in other parts of the world, that you still need to register for it, because that will then give you unlimited access to the online recording. So that's just a message from Paul Webber of Webber Training to make sure that you get the full benefit of the Webber Training company. So I'd just like to finish by thanking Debbie again for an enjoyable, informative and excellent presentation that she had absolutely no reason to be nervous about. So thank you very much, Debbie, and thank you to all who have been
listening. Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.